his excitement about grilling major crime figures like Vito Genovese and Joe Profaci turns to frustration as witness after witness defies him by invoking their right to silence. The Justice Department is of no help to Kennedy, refusing to prosecute those criminals who take the stand, saying there's not enough evidence to build a case. Bobby Kennedy, whose emotions are always transparent, grows increasingly bellicose during the proceedings. He slowly comes to the realization that this committee is losing ground to the enemy within, as he refers to the mafia. Typical is this conversation between Kennedy and Sam Giancana, the flashy Chicago leader of the outfit. At 50, the widower Giancana is known as a playboy mafioso, fond of the Las Vegas nightlife and palling around with entertainers like Frank Sinatra. He has also been arrested 70 times for acts of violence, including 3 times for murder. It is thought that he has authorized more than 200 mafia hits on his enemies. Footnote: Sam Giancana served time for many offenses, including a stretch in the federal correctional complex in Terre Haute, Indiana. However, wiretaps of Giancana speaking with fellow mob boss Stefano Magadino of Buffalo, New York, capture him bragging about the number of police chiefs on his payroll. Those bribes, along with the mob practice of insulating bosses from crimes, are the reasons Giancana is a free man in 1959. End footnote. Giancana is listed in the state of Nevada's Las Vegas Black Book, which shows the photographs of 11 suspected mafioso who are not allowed on the premises of any casino, which does not stop Giancana in the least. Frank Sinatra is known to hide the mobster in his dressing room at the Sands when FBI agents visit the casino. The two men often travel together, and Sinatra not only flies to Chicago to sing for free at Giancana's Villa Venice Club, but also closes the shows with "My Kind of Town, Chicago Is," as a tribute to Sam Giancana. The mobster repays the favor, showing his friendship by always wearing the sapphire pinky ring given to him by Frank Sinatra. When the singer films the movie Some Came Running in a town near Chicago, Giancana is a regular visitor to the set, often bringing his mafia underlings. Their nightly revelry amazed co-star Shirley MacLaine. "I didn't know who they were," she would remember of the anonymous mobsters. "I only knew that the nightlife of poker, jokes, pasta, and booze went on until 5 a.m. "Frank wanted to be a hood," singer Eddie Fisher will later marvel at Sinatra's fascination with Giancana. He once said, "I'd rather be a mafia don than president of the United States." The actor Peter Lawford, now married to Bobby Kennedy's sister Patricia, knows Giancana through his friendship with Sinatra. You better believe that when the word got out around Hollywood that Frank was a pal of Sam Giancana, nobody but nobody ever messed with Frank Sinatra. They were too scared. Concrete boots were no joke with this guy. He was a killer. Left unsaid in the committee room on this day is that John Kennedy is also a very good friend of Frank Sinatra and his band of fellow entertainers, nicknamed the Rat Pack. Sinatra and his crew often make jokes about their mafia connections. In doing so, they turn the mafia from the hoodlums depicted by Sergeant Crosswell in his earlier testimony into glamorous mystery men. The main event of the second McClellan hearing is Bobby Kennedy against Sam Giancana. The encounter does not go well for the government. "Mr. Kennedy, would you tell us, if you have opposition from anybody, that you dispose of them by having them stuffed in a trunk? Is that what you do, Mr. Giancana?" Sam Giancana: "I decline to answer because I honestly believe my answer might tend to incriminate me." Mr. Kennedy: "Would you tell us anything about any of your operations, or will you just giggle every time I ask you a question?" Sam Giancana: "I decline to answer because I honestly believe my answer might tend to incriminate me." Mr. Kennedy: "I thought only little girls giggled, Mr. Giancana." Sam Giancana will plead the fifth 34 times. The man who privately boasts, "I own Chicago, I own Miami, I own Las Vegas," admits nothing to Bobby Kennedy. The Fifth Amendment is for the innocent as well as the guilty. I can think of very few witnesses who availed themselves of it who, in my estimation, were free from wrongdoing, a weary Kennedy will admit. His frustration grows so great that he often turns off his microphone during hearings so that his words cannot be recorded. However, after yet another gangster pleads the Fifth, Kennedy's verbiage is picked up loud and clear. "You're full of shit." Over the course of the McClellan hearings, Bobby Kennedy has authorized 253 investigations, served 8,000 subpoenas, called 1,526 witnesses, and compiled 150,000 pages of testimony. Public awareness about organized crime is at an all-time high, but by the end of 1959, Americans are growing weary of the exposition. It will now be left to law enforcement to complete the task of prosecuting the mafia. And in a strange turn of events, it is Bobby Kennedy, not the mob, who is depicted as the villain. No one since Joseph McCarthy has done more than Mr. Kennedy to foster the impression that the plea of self-incrimination is tantamount to a confession of guilt, one law professor from Yale will write. In the summer of 1959, Bobby Kennedy resigns from the McClellan Committee. If there is an upbeat moment for the exhausted chief counsel, it is Vito Genovese's conviction in a New York courtroom on charges of drug trafficking. Prosecutors there succeeded where Kennedy did not, with a jury finding Genovese guilty of conspiring to import and sell narcotics. Never one to forget a grudge, the exiled Lucky Luciano allegedly struck back at Genovese all the way from Italy, arranging for a Puerto Rican drug dealer to implicate Vito Genovese in the sale of narcotics, leading to the 15-year sentence. Genovese will continue to run his crime family while serving his time at the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, even ordering executions of several of his enemies. Little else has changed. The five families still run New York. Sam Giancana and the outfit has never been more powerful in Chicago. Las Vegas is more firmly than ever in criminal hands. But in mob-infested Cuba, there is a new story. In 1959, communist rebel Fidel Castro seizes control of the corrupt island nation. On January 1st, Castro's rebel band captures Havana. The mob-run casinos had long been a source of anger to the Cuban people, for the wealth within their walls contrasted so sharply with their poverty. So one of Castro's first orders is the destruction of the casinos. Meyer Lansky's brand new Riviera Hotel, which the mobster spent millions to construct, is the scene of broken windows, smashed and burned slot machines, and even pigs set free to run loose in the hallways as a symbol of capitalist gluttony. Lansky had sensed that Castro would be successful in controlling Cuba, so on New Year's Eve, which should have been one of the busiest nights of the year, Lansky made the quick decision to close the Riviera and move all cash on the premises to a safe place. One week later, Meyer Lansky fled Cuba for the safety of the Bahamas, having lost a fortune due to Castro's revolution. In July 1959, an FBI team led by Agent Bill Romer sneaks into Solano's Custom Tailors on Michigan Avenue under cover of darkness. To their relief, the building is unguarded. Romer leads the FBI's Organized Crime Investigation Squad here in Chicago. The second-floor office the team soon enters belongs to Jimmy Solano, who makes a substantial portion of his living selling fine suits to members of the outfit. The room features a large sofa, easy chair, desk, and well-stocked bar, and a safe. Romer has learned that Solano loans out the room to the local mob each afternoon for private meetings. Agent Romer hopes to conceal a microphone within the office so that federal investigators can listen in. The task is not simple. The microphone is the size of a softball and not easily concealed. The agents must also run a wire from the microphone outside the building, then find a way to connect it with their headquarters 5 miles away on Clark Street. All the while, J. Edgar Hoover has informed Romer and his team that he will disavow any knowledge of their actions should they engage in gunfire with local mafioso or be arrested as burglars by the Chicago police. Working quickly, the agents succeed in concealing the microphone behind a radiator. Connecting the wire is not so simple. The team is forced to return to Solano's office on 6 different occasions, always a Sunday morning before dawn, before finally running the wire outside and down the building, then connecting it with the local telephone mainframe. It is July 29th, the birthday of Agent Romer's wife Jeannie, when the bug becomes active. Codenamed Little Al for the outfit's connection to Al Capone, the secret microphone is the first wiretap in the history of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The bug, as it is known, is illegal, and evidence gained through these transmissions cannot be used as evidence in court. Yet, due to overheard conversations between Sam Giancana and other mobsters in Jimmy Solano's office, the FBI can finally confirm the names of the top bosses of La Cosa Nostra and the fact that a national organized crime body known as the Commission has been in existence since 1931. With the planting of a single microphone, the FBI learns more about the mafia in 6 weeks than Bobby Kennedy's McClellan hearings established in 3 years. Footnote: Little Al will remain in operation until July 11, 1965, when it will go dead after years of continuous use. The outfit never knew of its existence. On one occasion, the mobsters swept the room for bugs to ensure they were not being overheard. The FBI was listening in on that conversation and successfully broke into the building once again, turned off Little Al to conceal its location, then returned to reactivate the microphone once the sweep was finished. It's worth noting that although the outfit was unaware that Romer was recording them, they were well aware that he was the agent assigned to investigate them. Upon learning that Romer coached his son's Little League team, the mobsters arranged that mob meetings take place during the team's practices. End footnote. Back in Washington, Jimmy Hoffa is not much concerned with Fidel Castro. His obsession remains with Robert Kennedy. He secretly meets with likely Republican presidential nominee Richard Nixon late in 1959 to offer a Teamster endorsement of his candidacy, knowing this could severely impact John Kennedy's hopes of winning the presidency in 1960. Subsequently, the Hoffa-Nixon relationship will be sorely tested as the presidential campaign unfolds. Meanwhile, the privately reckless JFK will soon do something that will appall his younger brother. Senator John Kennedy, relentless in his pursuits of women, will involve himself with a young lady named Judith Campbell, who will soon become the mistress of the very dangerous Sam Giancana. Chapter 13. February 7, 1960, Las Vegas, Nevada, 10 p.m. Frank Sinatra sees an old friend in the audience. A thick haze of cigarette smoke hangs over the packed Copa room. Near the stage where Sinatra performs, Antonio Morelli conducts an 18-piece orchestra. Each of the 385 audience members is ecstatic, having secured tickets to the hottest show in America. A little more than a decade after Bugsy Siegel's murder, Las Vegas has become the gambling mecca he once prophesied. More than 8 million Americans travel each year to Sin City, as Las Vegas is becoming known, spending more than $160 million annually on food, drinks, gambling, and lavish stage shows. Of course, the mob has a big piece, having divided up control of the Sands, Flamingo, Tropicana, Desert Inn, and Riviera casinos between the Chicago, Detroit, and New York families. Tonight's performance will last precisely 1 hour. Going just 1 minute longer, we'll delay the audience's return to the gaming tables, which is where the Sands Hotel and Casino makes its real money. Entertainment is just a diversion to draw gamblers through the door. So the audience sits at closely packed tables draped in white cloths, sipping their two-drink minimum, enthralled by the mellifluous singing of Frank Sinatra. But they also know that something special is soon to come. The Summit at the Sands is the act's formal title, but almost everyone in the crowd tonight calls it something else. The Rat Pack. Sinatra, now 44 years old, is soon to be joined by friends Dean Martin, Joey Bishop, Peter Lawford, and Sammy Davis Jr. for some witty banter and group harmony. Nothing is rehearsed. Nothing is sacred. By day, the group is filming a heist movie called Ocean's 11 on location here in Las Vegas. By night, they perform at the Copa. The grueling schedule includes after-show parties, followed by a visit to the steam room to sweat out the booze before a very late bedtime. Making the act even more unusual is that a different member of the Rat Pack headlines each show, performing his own songs until the others step on stage to interrupt the act, joking and singing along. The audience is never told ahead of time who will come on first, or what outlandish behavior they can expect. One bit has Martin and Bishop walking on stage in their underwear and tuxedo jackets, then launching into song along with Sinatra, all the while maintaining straight faces. The pack is so popular that more than 18,000 requests have been made for hotel reservations at the Sands during the three-week run from January 26th through February 16th. Unfortunately, the resort has just 212 rooms. Many patrons choose to sleep in their cars or even in the hotel lobby. And while the average gambler is unlikely to find lodging at the Sands, Hollywood stars have no such problem. Cary Grant, Kim Novak, Jack Benny, Lucille Ball, and Cole Porter are just a few of the celebrities who make the journey to Las Vegas to see the frenetic Rat Pack. Footnote: The Rat Pack was originally founded by actor Humphrey Bogart in the mid-1950s. Its membership included fellow actors David Niven, the hard-living Errol Flynn, and Frank Sinatra. Bogart's wife, actress Lauren Bacall, noted that their drunken escapades reminded her of a pack of rats, thus the name. When Bogart died in 1957, Sinatra transformed the group into a new collection focused around his personal friends. End footnote. But tonight, there is another celebrity in the house. "Ladies and gentlemen," Sinatra addresses the crowd. A spotlight plays over the room before settling upon a table up front near the stage. "Senator John F. Kennedy from the great state of Massachusetts." As the audience erupts into applause, Sinatra continues, "The next President of the United States." The perpetually tanned Kennedy rises to his feet and takes a bow as the audience gives him a standing ovation. Sinatra announces to the crowd that JFK is an honorary member of the Rat Pack, later even referring to the group as the Jack Pack. The spectators cannot help but notice the young brunette seated next to the senator. Most assume that this is Mrs. Kennedy. They are wrong. With his presidential campaign in full swing, JFK should be in the Pacific Northwest. That's where the candidate will deliver a speech to the Oregon Chamber of Commerce the day after tomorrow. This afternoon, the 42-year-old presidential hopeful delivered an earnest talk about developing the West's natural resources at a conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico. In just 1 month, voters in New Hampshire will go to the polls to open the electoral primary season, the first step toward winning the presidency. But as his personal plane, Caroline, named for his 2-year-old daughter, takes to the air for the journey to Newport, Oregon, Kennedy orders the pilot to alter his flight plan. Frank Sinatra has invited him to Vegas, promising JFK a good time. Rat Pack member Sammy Davis Jr. has made his personal car and chauffeur available to Kennedy. Sinatra will provide the girls. We all knew he was a swinger, Davis will later say about JFK. According to Sammy Davis, Sinatra procured an outside girl from Los Angeles to entertain Senator Kennedy. So, Oregon can wait. There was no goddamn reason for stopping there except fun and games, Blair Clark of CBS News, a college friend of the candidate and one of six journalists on the flight, will long remember. Footnote. Kennedy's Convair 240 was the first private aircraft utilized by a presidential candidate, allowing him freedom to travel without concern for commercial airline schedules. Joseph Kennedy bought the plane from American Airlines in 1959 and had it refitted for his son's personal use. Caroline revolutionized campaigning. Since 1960, it has become common for a candidate to travel by private aircraft rather than commercial. End footnote. But John Kennedy is an astute politician who knows better than to let the public believe he has only landed in Las Vegas to play. So earlier tonight, he spoke to 600 local Democrats at the city's convention center, hoping to shore up the organized labor vote, then attended a cocktail party with key local donors, many of whom are connected to the mafia through their roles in the hotel and casino industry. Only then did JFK slip away to this evening's late show. The Sands, in the words of one mafioso, is the hotel for wise guys. Footnote. The quote is by Gianni Russo, a mafioso in the employ of Frank Costello, who also played the role of Carlo Rizzi in The Godfather. End footnote. Kennedy is careful not to spend the night there, avoiding any overt association with organized crime. But there is no stigma in visiting the Copa Room to hear Frank Sinatra. The candidate and the singer have known each other for 5 years. Behind the scenes, Patriarch Joseph Kennedy is trying to leverage this friendship, hoping Sinatra will use his mafia connections to swing the labor vote toward Jack, as Kennedy is known by friends and family. The singer was recently invited to the Kennedy family compound in Palm Beach, Florida, where Joe Kennedy also requested that Sinatra sing a few benefit shows for JFK. The elder Kennedy even suggested that Sinatra record a special theme song. This led to the singer reworking the lyrics of High Hopes, which he had sung in the movie A Hole in the Head, into a catchy ditty about Jack Kennedy. Such behind-the-scenes politicking is a normal part of any presidential campaign, where no detail is too small to overlook. But there are two glaring weaknesses in the Kennedy machine that must be concealed at all costs. The first is Joseph Kennedy's links to organized crime. The other is JFK's rampant adultery, a habit learned from his father. One pivotal aspect of JFK's public persona is that of a dedicated family man. With the New Hampshire primary so close, it is imperative that this facade be maintained. But while Kennedy loves his wife, Jackie, and dotes on daughter Caroline, he also looks forward to nights like this, where he will share his bed with another woman. So, as JFK retakes his seat in the Copa Room following Sinatra's introduction, he is mesmerized by the gorgeous Judith Campbell. This is the outside girl Sinatra brought from Los Angeles. Even though JFK's 27-year-old brother Teddy is closer to Campbell's age, she fights off the younger Kennedy's relentless advances and focuses her attention on the elder brother. The blue-eyed Judith Campbell does all the talking as the senator zeroes in. It was as if every nerve in his body was poised at attention, she will long remember. As I was to learn, John Kennedy was the world's greatest listener. And the 26-year-old Campbell is the world's greatest social climber. She grew up the daughter of a wealthy Los Angeles architect with ties to the entertainment industry. One boyfriend from her teenage years was Robert Wagner. At 18, she married the actor William Campbell, an alcoholic who appeared in horror films. Just before that marriage, Campbell met the influential and shadowy, handsome Johnny Roselli, an enforcer from Chicago who oversees the outfit's West Coast and Las Vegas operations for mob boss Sam Giancana. Despite being almost 25 years older, Roselli is smitten. Beautiful. Looks like Liz Taylor, but nicer. A real sweet kid. Comes from a good family. Lots of class, the mobster will tell a friend. And Roselli has lots of friends, including Joseph Kennedy, with whom he often plays golf and cards. Now divorced, with no formal education beyond high school, a monthly alimony payment of just $433.33, and with no desire to enter the workforce, Judy Campbell uses her wholesome beauty and intellect to cultivate friendships in the most elite Hollywood circles. This means a steady whirl of parties, nightclubs, and relationships with powerful men. Among these is Roselli. The two have a brief affair, but the mobster chooses to pass Judy along to Frank Sinatra, whose close friendship with Sam Giancana is second only to that of Roselli. Campbell is soon vacationing in Hawaii with Sinatra. Also making that trip is actor Peter Lawford of the Rat Pack and his wife, Patricia Kennedy Lawford, JFK's sister. Soon, the moody Sinatra and Judy Campbell begin to argue. She decides to fly home early, the relationship seemingly over. But it's not. That vacation occurred in November 1959. Yet if Judy Campbell is surprised when Sinatra invites her to spend a weekend in Las Vegas, she does not show it. Nor does she suspect that Frank is using her to ingratiate himself with JFK, at least not at first. But soon the dynamic becomes quite clear. They seemed to have a genuine mutual admiration society. Frank was in awe of Jack's background and his power, Campbell will later remember, and Jack was mesmerized by Sinatra's swinging lifestyle. Indeed, those who meet JFK in his unguarded private moments are often amazed at his fondness for women, parties, and the belief that he can get away with anything. The relationship between John F. Kennedy and Judith Campbell will last for 2 years. Their dalliance will be kept secret, or so JFK thinks. It all begins with their flirtation in the Copa Room tonight. Frank Sinatra's guess has proven correct. Despite the bimbos and showgirls flocking around the table, in the words of newsman Blair Clark, the candidate only has eyes for Campbell. Coincidentally, she bears an amazing resemblance to Kennedy's wife, Jackie. The whole thing is a setup. The mafia knows JFK's weakness for women and means to use Judy Campbell as a source of blackmail if necessary. There is speculation that Sam Giancana himself ordered Campbell to Las Vegas using Frank Sinatra as the go-between. They deliberately fed her to Jack, actor Brad Dexter, a good friend of Sinatra's, will recall. And Frank was part of it. Very serious. After the show, JFK and Campbell join the raging party in Sinatra's suite, with free-flowing alcohol, cocaine, and a bevy of beautiful showgirls. Campbell is popular with most men because she still projects the healthy image of a young, wholesome girl. But at the Sands, she is notorious in the sense that we knew who she was, and that we considered her a high-class call girl who could be bought, in the words of one gaming dealer. Kennedy does not know this, nor is he aware that Campbell was procured specifically for him. Footnote. This is not the first time Campbell and Kennedy met, so it was known at the time that JFK had an eye for her. Their first encounter came months earlier at Puccini Restaurant in Beverly Hills. Senator Kennedy was dining with Sinatra when the two spied Campbell sitting with actress Angie Dickinson. End footnote. Campbell will later claim Kennedy does not force himself on her this first night, nor does she offer herself. In her version of events, they just make conversation. "When you talked to Jack," Campbell will later recall, "he talked just to you. He was endlessly curious about everything and everybody. He loved gossip. That night, he did not want me to leave his side." FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover will eventually get a detailed memo on Kennedy's sex activities from this Vegas weekend, but Campbell will long state that the candidate does not sleep with her on this occasion. She claims she returned to her own room in the early morning hours and he went alone to his suite at the El Rancho Hotel farther down the strip. According to Campbell, the first voice she hears the following morning is that of JFK, calling to invite her to lunch in Sinatra's suite. This is the first of many phone calls between the two as Kennedy campaigns around the country. "He called almost every day," she will later write, "no matter where he was or how tired." 1 month later, as the race takes Kennedy through New York City, he and Campbell rendezvous once again, this time at the Plaza Hotel. It is March 7th, the eve of the New Hampshire primary and the first crucial step on John Kennedy's road to the White House, when Campbell claims the couple first consummates their relationship. Footnote: Judith Campbell Exner wrote a memoir in 1977 entitled My Story, about her affair with JFK. At first, it was disputed by the Kennedy family, and Campbell weakened the veracity of her claims by changing details of her story several times. But as more details about Kennedy's womanizing came to light, Campbell's story turned out to be mostly true, at least according to FBI wiretaps. However, to this day, some historians believe Campbell exaggerated to make money. End footnote. Just 2 weeks after Campbell and Kennedy meet in New York, Frank Sinatra once again invites the young beauty to take a trip with him. And once again, despite the callous manner in which she has been treated, Judy says yes. This time, the destination is the Fontainebleau in Miami. The singer has been a regular headliner in the luxury hotel's La Ronde nightclub since 1954, but on this occasion, he is taping a television special welcoming Elvis Presley back from his 2 years in the Army. The performance takes place on March 26, 1960, and is bathed in irony. Once upon a time, Frank Sinatra was the skinny young teenage idol for whom all the girls screamed. Now his hair is thinning and his voice husky from constant smoking and drinking Jack Daniels. Elvis Presley is the new icon. His rock and roll sound has revolutionized modern music, replacing the standards for which Sinatra is known best. In effect, Frank Sinatra is welcoming home his replacement. Within a few short years, Las Vegas will be one of the only venues where Sinatra's sound will reign, and Presley is soon to make his mark there, too. Thus, the television broadcast 6 weeks from now will become a seminal moment in entertainment television history. But even more interesting than the show are the actions taking place behind the scenes in Miami. Frank Sinatra has brought Judy Campbell here to be his plaything, considering her a hooker. In the beautiful and willing young woman, Sinatra also sees a means of expanding his personal empire by keeping his powerful friends happy. "I don't think it takes a great deal of imagination," Campbell will write years later, "to think there is a possibility I was used." So during a private party, Sinatra introduces Campbell to a gentleman. "Come here, Judy," she will write in her memoir. "I want you to meet a good friend of mine, Sam Flood." Campbell will long claim that this is her first meeting with Sam Giancana, as he is actually named. The 52-year-old widower is twice Campbell's age, a dour and physically unattractive man. But his tailored sharkskin suit, expensive alligator shoes, silk shirt, and powerful bearing signal a man of means. In truth, there is a good chance Judy Campbell already knows the gangster, even if they have not been properly introduced. For Giancana is the best friend of her former lover, Johnny Roselli. And it is already a well-known fact that she has had several relationships with mafia figures. Rat Pack member Peter Lawford specifically refers to Campbell as a mob moll. What Judy Campbell does not know is that on this night in March, she is about to become the center of a complex maelstrom of sex, politics, and crime. Sex. Judith Campbell is having an affair with John Kennedy and is about to begin another with Sam Giancana. Politics. Joseph Kennedy recently had lunch with Johnny Roselli and Sam Giancana at Felix Young's restaurant in New York City to discuss ways in which the mafia could assist JFK's campaign. This comes less than 8 months after Bobby Kennedy famously grilled Giancana before the McClellan hearings. The mob boss tells a nervous Joe Kennedy that he does not have a problem with JFK, but he is still angry about Bobby's public attacks on him. Joe Kennedy argues that his son's disrespect is in the past and reminds Giancana that it's Jack who's running for president, not Bobby. Kennedy also tells the mobster that if he helps get JFK elected, the president will owe him a favor. This is business, not politics, Kennedy concludes before leaving the dinner early so that Roselli and Giancana might discuss the matter alone. Crime. Sam Giancana has bribed and blackmailed politicians and law enforcement officials throughout Illinois, a state vital to winning the presidency. He has the power to rig an election, but he's still not sure JFK should be supported. Footnote. Nick Savano, a member of Frank Sinatra's inner circle, will go on record as stating that JFK also dined with Giancana while still a member of the Senate. Jack was very respectful to Giancana, Savano will recall. End footnote. So it is that Judith Campbell sleeps with Sam Giancana, even as she continues to speak with JFK on the phone every day and bed the candidate whenever his schedule allows. All of these private actions take place in the midst of the very public spectacle of the 1960 presidential campaign. At first, JFK does not know about Giancana, but the mob boss surely knows all about Campbell and the senator, and is thrilled that JFK has a regular who might prove a source of blackmail and insider knowledge. Judy Campbell is now a conduit, providing a direct connection between a man seeking the most powerful office in the world and a man that commands the underworld. And all the while, J. Edgar Hoover is listening in. Part 3. The Subversives. Chapter 14. July 11, 1960, Los Angeles, California, 5 p.m. The most powerful man in Hollywood is on the phone. 15 miles away, in the heart of downtown Los Angeles, the entertainment capital of the world is on display for all to see. The day has been hot, and the City of Angels is wreathed in smog. Now, as evening falls, more than 7,000 Democrats from all across America crowd into the sports arena, soon to be the home of the Los Angeles Lakers basketball team. They are here to select a presidential nominee. 16 primary elections have been held in the past 4 months, with John F. Kennedy winning 10 of them. The Massachusetts senator appears to be the frontrunner among those vying to gain the nomination. Footnote. They are Senators Stuart Symington of Missouri, Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota, Wayne Morse of Oregon, and George Smathers of Florida. Lyndon Johnson, Adlai Stevenson, and Governor Robert Maynor of New Jersey will join them. End footnote. Joseph Kennedy, leaving nothing to chance, has stopped in Las Vegas en route to the convention and placed a massive $1 million bet on his son to win the presidency, thus ensuring that the oddsmakers will tout JFK as the favorite. Ironically, the Kennedy patriarch will not be making an appearance at the convention. His strong anti-Semitic beliefs have made him a political pariah. At such a pivotal moment in the campaign, his son cannot risk the controversy Joe Kennedy's presence will elicit. For while John Kennedy may appear to be the frontrunner, recent developments are endangering his candidacy. The popular Texas Senator Lyndon B. Johnson announced his own run 2 days ago, as did Democratic candidate Adlai Stevenson from Illinois. The winner will be decided over the next 2 days of argument, debate, and roll calls in Los Angeles. But before the politicking begins, it is time to entertain the delegates Hollywood style. At 5 p.m., The crowd grows quiet as a military color guard brings forth the American flag. Alaska and Hawaii were admitted to the Union just 1 year ago, so the standard has a unique new look with 50 stars instead of 48. In addition to delegates, the crowd is packed with movie stars, among them three members of the Rat Pack. Last night, at a $100 per plate gala at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Dean Martin entertained a crowd of 2,800 enthusiastic Kennedy backers. For the closing night of the convention, the three singers have arranged for an all-star chorus consisting of 30 major Hollywood stars to serenade the delegates. Footnote: among those appearing were Shirley MacLaine, Myrna Loy, Vincent Price, Nat King Cole, Shelley Winters, Janet Leigh, Charlton Heston, and Edward G. Robinson. End footnote. For the city of Los Angeles, hosting the convention is a bid at seeking world-class legitimacy. L.A. is mostly known for making movies and for whimsical attractions like nearby Disneyland. Indeed, the delegates are treated to backstage tours at the Hollywood studios and have flocked to the Magic Kingdom during their brief stay. Late-night parties at watering holes like Chasen's and Romanoff's will include icons like Henry Fonda, Jack Lemmon, Gary Cooper, and Lauren Bacall. The connection between Hollywood and Washington that will soon become pivotal to national politics can be said to have begun with the glamour and glitz of the 1960 Democratic National Convention. To mark the beginning of the proceedings, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Dean Martin are introduced, along with a dozen other celebrities. Democratic Party leaders hope to dazzle the audience watching on national television with this display of Hollywood wattage. The spectacle backfires temporarily when Davis is booed by pro-segregation Southern delegates because he is openly dating the white actress Mae Britt. But Frank Sinatra ends the rancor. He is given a prolonged round of applause as he steps on stage. The house lights are brought all the way down. Then, under a lone spotlight, Sinatra performs the Star-Spangled Banner. Footnote: it is worth noting that Sinatra also sang the national anthem at the Democratic National Convention in 1956. He later became a Republican. End footnote. Thus begins three nights of democracy in action, as the deeply divided delegates argue and feud before eventually choosing their candidate. With so few states holding primaries, the majority of voters are free to select whomever they want. And as the delegates battle, John Kennedy stays above the fray, cavorting with Marilyn Monroe and Judith Campbell in an apartment on Rossmore Avenue borrowed from actor Jack Haley. But by July 13th, it is done. John Fitzgerald Kennedy wins a majority on the first ballot. In the Hollywood mansion of Marion Davies, where Joseph Kennedy and Frank Sinatra get the news together, the singer jumps up and down shouting, "We're going to the White House." Thus, the man whose father assured Sam Giancana that the President of the United States would owe him a favor is now just one general vote away from taking up residence in the White House. Yet, on this historic night, Kennedy is not the most powerful man in Hollywood. That distinction belongs to a shadowy figure known as the Fixer. Very few people know the name Sidney Korshak, a.k.a. the Fixer, which is exactly how he wants it. The tall, immaculately dressed mafia attorney lives in the wealthy Los Angeles enclave of Bel Air. Korshak is 53 years old, a Chicago-born Jew of Lithuanian descent. His FBI case file number is 92-789. He and his wife Bernice, B to friends, live lavishly. The walls of their newly purchased home on Chalon Road are decorated in original works by Renoir and Chagall. Their wine cellar is stocked with the most expensive vintages. Their exclusive annual Christmas party is attended by the likes of Peter and Patricia Kennedy Lawford, Dinah Shore, Robert Evans, Tony Curtis, and Cubby Broccoli, the producer currently working on his first movie about a British secret agent named James Bond. Like most homes in Bel Air, the Korshak property is ringed by an impenetrable wall of shrubs and towering trees, offering complete privacy. Unlike other homes in the neighborhood, however, the front door is answered by a security guard armed with a loaded pistol. Korshak's garage is filled with a Rolls-Royce, Jaguar, Mercedes, and a Cadillac. But he prefers to hire a car and driver when traveling to meetings with top mobsters like Sam Giancana. The actions of Sidney Korshak are veiled in secrecy and difficult to document. But his success hinges on his uncanny ability of convincing people to do what they don't want to do. An example of his influence is the time comedian Alan King attempted to check into a plush Paris hotel, but is turned away by the front desk, citing lack of availability. A frustrated King calls Korshak from a lobby payphone. Before the comedian can even hang up, a clerk is standing outside the phone booth, ready to guide King to a suite. But more frequent are calls no one knows about, thus Korshak's reputation as the fixer. A nod from Korshak, Hollywood producer and Korshak protege Robert Evans will later write, and the Teamsters change management. A nod from Korshak, and Vegas shuts down. A nod from Korshak, and the Dodgers can suddenly play night baseball. 6 years from now, in 1966, it will be a call from Korshak that will elevate Robert Evans to the position as the chief executive at Paramount Pictures. Footnote: the signature film during Evans's time at Paramount was The Godfather. Director Francis Ford Coppola was determined that Al Pacino play the role of Michael Corleone, but Pacino was contractually obligated to another film whose producer would not release him from the contract. Korshak made a phone call on Evans's behalf, and within 20 minutes, Pacino was free to play Michael Corleone. End footnote. In a city like Hollywood, where fame is the calling card most residents crave, Sidney Korshak shuns the spotlight. He never allows his picture to be taken. As the outfit's legal counsel, Korshak not only consorts with mobsters like Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli, but also with labor leaders like Ronald Reagan, currently president of the Screen Actors Guild. By controlling unions such as SAG, the mafia runs Hollywood. It is Korshak, in a conversation with Lou Wasserman, Reagan's agent, who insists that Reagan seek a second term as SAG president, which he does. And it is not just the Hollywood labor unions. Korshak has deep ties to Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters. In show business, there are many who believe that the dapper lawyer is more powerful than the union president. This will be clearly evidenced in October 1961 when Korshak travels to Las Vegas and checks in to the Riviera Hotel during a national conference for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Korshak requests the presidential suite, even though it is currently occupied by Jimmy Hoffa. Within moments, the labor leader's belongings are moved to smaller accommodations. The truth is, Korshak's influence is everywhere. A decade ago, it was the lawyer who presented Senator Estes Kefauver with photographic blackmail, pictures of him with a mistress, thus bringing about an abrupt end to the Kefauver hearings against organized crime. And it is Korshak who knows the names and motivations of Bugsy Siegel's killers, even as the Los Angeles police struggle to find a single clue. Organized crime has been a fixture on the Hollywood scene since the early days of cinema. Cedric Belfrage, a British writer who arrived in the 1920s, described the pervasive gangster element in the movie world. The Jewish movie moguls of Eastern European birth are like the Sicilian mobsters in many ways, in particular their tight ethnic culture, immigrant origins, and outsider status in America. Traditional banks do not lend money to people like that. Thus, the studio heads turn to the mafia. As Sidney Korshak well knows, the film industry needs the mob for financing. Traditional banks are loath to make loans to movie studios because the success or failure of a film is never certain, and as stated, they don't like the element in charge. However, organized crime could not care less about that. It is looking for ways to launder cash accrued illegally, so investing in a motion picture offers an ideal opportunity. In addition, just like in their Las Vegas casinos, the mob adds to its bottom line by skimming money off a film's profits. In some instances, actors are not paid their full salary, a brutal yet effective way for the mob to make even more money. Few actors complain because those who do soon find themselves unable to work. Nobody can skim as well as Las Vegas because they invented it, director Richard Brooks will comment, but Hollywood is second. New York mobster Henry Hill will one day write of Hollywood, "On the surface, this world seems as far away from the gangster life as you can imagine, but the slime below the surface is sickening. It recently occurred to me that my adventures in the mob prepared me nicely for swimming with the sharks on Wilshire Boulevard." Organized crime in Los Angeles began just after the turn of the 20th century, with an Italian-American gang making big money bootlegging alcohol. In time, the gang grew in power, enabling its boss, Tom Dragna, born in Sicily, to secure a spot on the commission, the national crime syndicate founded by Lucky Luciano in 1931. No other individual west of Chicago was so honored. But the arrival of Bugsy Siegel in 1937 spawned a rivalry. The Los Angeles crime family was slowly replaced by Siegel and his New York connections. The first Hollywood labor unions were just beginning to organize, and Dragna was slow to insert himself. But Siegel managed to do so almost immediately. A Hollywood film is a cooperative effort, requiring writers, carpenters, painters, electricians, teamsters, and many more skills specific to motion pictures. Movies do not get made without these artisans. By controlling the unions as well as providing movie funding, the mafia effectively runs Hollywood. In fact, big stars like Debbie Reynolds, Dinah Shore, and Jill St. John are just a few of the many celebrities benefiting, at least indirectly, from the power of organized crime. Kirk Douglas is among Sidney Korshak's closest celebrity friends, a list that also includes Warren Beatty, Jack Benny, Sid Charisse, David Janssen, and Vincent Minnelli. It pays to be a friend of the fixer. When Frank Sinatra's acting career appeared to be over in the early 1950s, it was a phone call to Columbia Pictures president Harry Cohn that secured him the supporting role in From Here to Eternity that won Sinatra an Oscar. Likewise, when Korshak entered into a sexual affair with Ms. St. John, he convinced the actress to buy shares in a Las Vegas casino operation. This meant that when making the film Diamonds Are Forever, she will actually be part owner of the casino where the movie is being filmed. Korshak's insider information eventually makes the actress very wealthy when the Parvin Dorman Casino Group is purchased by the Stardust Hotel. No group benefits more than the mafia when union membership in Los Angeles leaps from 20,000 in 1936 to 125,000 in 1938. Actor George Raft, who is very often cast as a mobster, is one of Bugsy Siegel's best friends and helps the newcomer navigate the world of Hollywood politics. Footnote: George Raft modeled his on-screen gangster persona on the voice and style of dress of New York City mobster Joey Adonis. End footnote. Though the territory still technically belongs to Tom Dragna and his L.A. crime family, Siegel slowly assumes control. After Siegel is murdered in Beverly Hills, a man named Mickey Cohen seizes power, but he is sent to prison in 1951 for tax evasion. Dragna, in turn, dies of a heart attack in 1956. The demise of Tom Dragna and Mickey Cohen presents an opening for the Chicago mob. The outfit is represented by Johnny Roselli, taking orders from Sam Giancana. And while Giancana has been head of the Chicago mob since 1957, he prefers the sizzle of Hollywood to life in the Windy City, and spends a great deal of his time consorting with movie stars and his singer girlfriend, Phyllis McGuire, of the famous McGuire sisters. Roselli and Giancana are both enamored with celebrity nightlife, preferring to let someone else manage day-to-day business arrangements. That someone is Sidney Korshak. There is nothing the mob boss does not control in Hollywood. Craft unions, casting, talent agencies, and even studio heads. Columbia Pictures president Harry Cohn, a longtime associate of Roselli, borrowed $500,000 from the mob to obtain control of the studio. The deal was structured in a way that the mob secretly retained one-third ownership. Roselli and Cohn were such good friends that they wore similar pinky rings as a sign of brotherhood. Upon Cohn's death in 1958, Sidney Korshak was appointed legal advisor to the mogul's estate. Footnote: Harry Cohn was one of the most volatile individuals in the history of Hollywood, with a manic and profanity-laced style that would become the caricature for movie mogul behavior. He also made liberal use of his mafia ties. When African-American singer Sammy Davis Jr., who lost his left eye in an automobile accident, began dating the white actress Kim Novak, Cohn threatened to have Davis's other eye put out unless the affair ended. The biracial relationship eventually halted, but only when Sidney Korshak intervened and reminded Davis that his career would effectively be over if he did not comply. End footnote. It was well known in the industry, FBI agent Mike Wax will later recall to journalists, that if you were going to make a movie, the talk around the town was that you'd have to use the Teamsters. Of course, you better get it straightened out with Sidney before you get those Teamsters over there, or you could have problems. He'd get a consulting fee from both ends, the producers as well as the Teamsters. I wish we could have proven that. In fact, Korshak's name has come up in more than 20 investigations of organized crime, yet he has never been indicted. This is a credit to his discretion. When other mafiosi gathered in New York for the Apalachin Summit, Korshak thought it too public a gathering and stayed away. When the FBI succeeded in bugging the outfit's Chicago headquarters, Korshak's voice is never heard on tape because he refuses to go there. In fact, Korshak is so cautious about security that he will never use a telephone he believes might be tapped. On one occasion, federal agents watch in amazement as he enters a phone booth carrying a large bag filled with loose change to make a number of calls. To frustrate law enforcement officials even further, Korshak does not use credit cards, often carrying as much as $50,000 on his person in large bills. On occasion, however, investigators are successful in peeling back the layers behind Korshak's activities. During a federal extortion trial concerning mafia involvement in the motion picture industry and organized labor, union official Willie Bioff testifies that he was told by the Chicago mob that Sidney is our man, and we want you to do what he tells you. He is not just another lawyer, but knows our gang and figures our best interest. Pay attention to him, and remember, any message he may deliver to you is a message from us. In the recording of one FBI wiretap, federal agents overhear members of the Chicago mob giving directions to mobster Leslie Killer Kane Cruz. Never personally contact Sidney Korshak, hoodlum attorney. Which points to the very reason Sidney Korshak remains a free man, even as other mafiosi are being sent to the penitentiary. He protects himself. The Justice Department will refer to the attorney as the most significant link in the relationship between the crime syndicate, politics, labor, and management. In time, Korshak's client list will expand to include Hilton and Hyatt Hotels, the Los Angeles Dodgers, and the Madison Square Garden Corporation in New York, owner of the New York Knicks and New York Rangers hockey team. Yet lower-level mobsters are forbidden from even speaking to him. Sydney was up on a plateau we never really got to, one law enforcement officer will later remember. It never came down to our level. We never ran across him. We never saw Sydney meeting with the guys. Sydney was always meeting with lawyers, with legitimate people. This is how the secretive Sydney Korshak runs Hollywood. Desi Arnaz does not take Korshak's call, much to his peril. The Cuban-born star of the sitcom I Love Lucy is one of the biggest names in television, so famous and powerful that he fears no one in Hollywood. In addition to taping his own show with his wife, the comedian Lucille Ball, he now produces several other television programs. Among them is a crime drama called The Untouchables. Based on a true figure, Treasury agent Elliot Ness, played by Robert Stack, the production follows fictitious prohibition battles in Chicago. The law enforcement group headed by Ness is made up almost entirely of white males, with the agent known as Rico the only individual with obvious ethnic Italian heritage. Ironically, this agent is played by an actor of Greek ancestry. The bad guys in the show are almost all Italian-American. In addition, the actor portraying Al Capone, Neville Brand, acts like a vicious psychopath. This not only enrages Capone's widow May, but also makes Sam Giancana very angry. Coincidentally, Desi Arnaz was once a good friend of Sonny Capone, the gangster's only son. The Capone family believes they were instrumental in helping the Arnaz family flee Cuba in 1933 and are wounded by the depiction of their late father. The pressure begins. In New York, union leader Tony Anastasia, brother of the assassinated Albert, orders longshoremen not to unload crates of cigarettes manufactured by Liggett and Myers, a sponsor of the program. In Hollywood, Frank Sinatra moves his production company off the lot at Desilu Gower Studios, owned by Arnaz. "What do you want me to do?" Arnaz screams at furious Sinatra. "Make them all Jews?" The two men nearly come to blows when Arnaz calls Sinatra a television failure. But the singer knows better than to punch him. Through the many highs and lows in his career, Sinatra has learned that challenging power is not a recipe for success. In Chicago, the pressure also builds. Sam Giancana actually orders Desi Arnaz killed. Jimmy the Weasel Fratiano, just released after 6 years in San Quentin, is assigned the job. "Have you seen that TV show, The Untouchables?" asks Johnny Roselli when he sits down with Fratiano to discuss the situation. "I don't have time to watch that shit," replies the Weasel. "Let me tell you something, Jimmy. Millions of people all over the world see this show every fucking week. It's even popular in Italy. And what they see is a bunch of Italian lunatics running around with machine guns, slopping up spaghetti like a bunch of fucking pigs." "Nobody pays attention to that shit," Fratiano says. "It's like a comic book, a joke, who cares?" Roselli responds immediately. "I'll tell you, Jimmy, Sam cares. What I'm about to tell you has been decided by our family. The top guys have voted a hit. We're going to clip Desi Arnaz, the producer of this show." Footnote. The source of this conversation is Fratiano's biography, The Last Mafioso, and is repeated in Gus Russo's The Outfit. It does not appear that Lucille Ball, wife of Desi Arnaz and the most famous individual in television at the time, had any knowledge of the pending mafia hit. Fratiano would later go on to become acting boss of the L.A. crime family, then enter the Federal Witness Protection Program in 1980 after agreeing to testify against the mafia because he was facing murder charges. The Weasel would be dropped from the program after publication of his autobiography. He died of Alzheimer's disease in 1993. End footnote. A stunned Fratiano knows he must follow orders, but he is wary of the publicity surrounding the murder of a celebrity. The police investigation is sure to be intense. A return to the penitentiary is the last thing he wants right now. So Fratiano stalls, hoping that Sam Giancana might somehow have a change of heart and call off the hit. Meanwhile, unaware that his life is in danger, Desi Arnaz begins to realize that the Untouchables is losing money. Sponsors are backing out, refusing to purchase commercial time. Hollywood unions are also threatening to not allow their members to work on the Untouchables, which would shut down production entirely. These setbacks are carefully orchestrated by Sidney Korshak. So, in an act that will save his life, a desperate Arnaz schedules a meeting with Johnny Roselli and Frank Sinatra. The three gather in the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel. "This is getting crazy," Arnaz begins. "What do you want me to do? How can I make this work for you?" "Stop every week with these terrible Italian mobsters," says Roselli. "It's an insult to the good Italian people." "Okay, we'll change all the names," Arnaz replies. "We'll call them Smith and Jones from now on." "And while you're at it, make one of the good guys an Italian," Roselli responds. "I already got an Italian untouchable. His name's Rico," Arnaz tells the mobster. But Roselli is ahead of him. "Not so fast. That actor's Greek. You gotta get an Italian actor." "Who do you want me to put in?" "Well, let me think a minute," Roselli responds. "There's a pal of mine. He'd be great in there." Footnote. The actor's name was Paul Percini. End footnote. Arnaz complies. Roselli's friend is cast. The hit is called off. And while members of the mafia will recount the details of the ordered murder for years to come, Desi Arnaz will never know how close he came to death. The Democratic National Convention ends with John F. Kennedy in triumph. Hollywood and Sidney Korshak return to business as usual. But in Illinois, Sam Giancana gets set to enter a different business, politics. The mobster throws his support and power behind the Kennedy campaign. That will alter history. Chapter 15. September 26, 1960, Chicago, Illinois, 7 p.m. Richard Nixon is beginning to sweat. Sitting under the hot lights of a television studio, the Vice President of the United States wears a thin coat of cheap pancake makeup known as Lazy Shave, designed to hide Nixon's 5 o'clock shadow.